You are listening to an American Free Press podcast.
Joining me on the line is Gary Byrne, the author of Crisis of Character. Gary, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Gary, I read your wonderful book, Crisis of Character, a White House Secret Service officer discloses his firsthand experience with Hillary, Bill, and how they operate. And I want to get into that in great detail in a moment. But before we do, for the benefit of the listeners, can you give them a little bit of background about who you are, about Gary Byrne?
Sure.
I know a little bit about you because I read your book, and always when I read people's books, I feel somewhat close to them, that I know them,
sure.
But the audience might not be aware of that.
Sure. I'm from a little town outside of Philadelphia. I joined the Air Force in 1982. I was a security policeman in the Air Force from 82 to 86. When I got out for a couple of years, I worked at a large aircraft manufacturer. And then in 1991, I got the opportunity to join the Secret Service Uniform Division. And it was a dream come true for me. I spent 12 years in the Secret Service Uniform Division, 1991 to 2003. I like to say that I came in with Papa Bush and I left with Son Bush.
Right.
And in between, I protected the Clintons for 8 years. And that's really who I am. I'm just a simple guy who loves law enforcement. I was drawn into law enforcement as a kid. For a short period of time, I lived down in Virginia, and our neighbor across the street was an Air Force security policeman, and I see him walk out in his uniform every day, and I was kind of hooked. Enjoyed what I did. I loved it. I spent 29 years total in the federal service. And then a couple years ago, well, you know, I experienced many things during my career, as you know from reading my book. But the thing that kind of brought it to a head and kind of compelled me, when I realized Mrs. Clinton was going to make another run for the White House, and I lived through the 8 years of her husband and her presidency, because I have no doubt when the American people voted Bill Clinton into office in the early 90s, they got Bill and Hillary. And if Mrs. Clinton gets elected in 2016, you're going to get Hillary and Bill. So I felt compelled to tell my story. Originally, the story was going to be called Fence Jumpers to Hijackers, because it was about my life. And then eventually, when I got a publisher, they wanted to change the name. Crisis of Character is not just about the Clintons' crisis of character. It's about my crisis of character. Coming out, telling my story. I took an oath of office, which is an oath to the presidency and the Constitution. But, you know, I pretty much told the Secret Service I would take these stories to the grave. But unfortunately, I ended up being the first Secret Service employee ever compelled to testify against the sitting president in a criminal case, and that was the Monica Lewinsky case. And I was subpoenaed 6 times, and then eventually I was ordered to testify by Supreme Court Justice Chief Rehnquist. Not something you want to put on your resume, but it is what it is. So I wanted the American people to know who the real Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton are before they have to make this decision for this election. There's a lot of young people out there that only know the Clintons from the propaganda that they put out about their campaign, and that's not even close to what the real Clintons are.
Right.
So, and that's why I wrote my book and why I wanted to get the truth out.
Mm-hmm. I read a lot of books.
Mm-hmm.
I read books and interview authors. And, of course, I can't read every book. I'd love to. But the reason I contacted you or reached out to you was because I took a look at your Facebook page and you had made mention about the mainstream media blackout of the book. And I saw that and I said, geez, that's interesting. And that's a topic that has always interested me.
Yeah.
And so that's how I reached out to you. And, of course, your publicist sent me the book. It is an easy read. It's compelling. Is this your first book, Gary?
It is. It is.
Yeah, very, very well written.
Well,
and when I was reading it, and I was probably about halfway through, and a term came to my head, and that was national treasure. And I don't say that lightly. Because I read so many books, and because there's so many books out there, to call one book by a former Secret Service officer who's not a writer a national treasure, why would I say that? And the reason I say that is because what you provide to the reader is an inside glimpse of American history. And that is so important for people to see. For someone who was in the White House, whose eyes were on everything that's in the White House, who knew every nook and cranny of the White House because you had to.
Yep.
Here's an insider's view of this institution that many people have idealized. And that's why I think your book is so important, because you were able to succinctly and successfully and clearly put your experiences down into words and provide the reader with a look into this house that they never, ever would have had before.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. That's one of the things that's important for your listeners to understand and your readers is that you always hear in campaigns, it doesn't matter what initial they start with, whether it's a Republican or a Democrat, they always talk about transparency, and you know, we never really see much of it. And certainly with the Clinton administration, the Bill Clinton administration, and now the Hillary Clinton administration, certainly the Hillary Clinton that was in the State Department, they like to talk about transparency, but the American people never really see it. This is the only way you're going to see it. It was very, very, it's still tough for me to talk about some of these things. I never thought I would talk about them outside of school, as we called it in the Secret Service. But I'm so adamant about the American people knowing who the real Hillary Clinton is. This is who they really are in my book. And if you take my book and you did a little bit of more research, which I'm sure you're aware of this, but you know, one of the first jobs that Hillary Clinton had as a young lawyer was working on the Watergate case, investigating President Richard Nixon for the Watergate break-in. The person that hired her, the lead Democrat in charge of the investigation, actually fired her for dishonesty. You take that by itself and you fast forward to today, what we know about her when she was Secretary of State, what happened, what we know that happened and didn't happen in Benghazi. Who was a U.S. senator for 8 years and doesn't know that she can't set up her own private server? And the only reason you would do that is to hide information. So the only transparency that a lot of people are ever going to get on the Clinton machine is from my book, Crisis of Character. And again, that's one of the compelling reasons I step forward to do this. I honestly believe, you know, after protecting presidents in the Secret Service and the American public as an air marshal, I feel this is my mission now, to get the truth out there. If people still want to vote for her because that's their beliefs, I'm fine with it. That's our system. But know what the truth is and then act on it.
Right. Thank you, Gary, so much for writing this. I'm of the mind that I like to wake up every day and try to learn a bunch of things. And that's one of the reasons I love what I do. And here with this book, it really allowed me to learn tons of things. I mean, literally tons of things. Your life is pretty fascinating, as
you
point out. And I don't want to really, I would love to, hey, if we hung out and had some cheesesteaks or pulled pork, you know, and talked it over, you know, that would be great.
Yeah.
But for the listeners, really, my advice would be, and I say this sometimes, but really, not very many books could stand up to this book for the reason that I mentioned. Get the book. Really, from a strictly educational standpoint, and nothing partisan or political, just to learn, to get your head inside of the White House, get your head inside of Gary's, who really, at the base of it, as you explained to me in this book, Gary, you're a cop, basically.
I am.
Yeah, that's what you've always wanted to be, and that's what you were, a Leo, law enforcement officer.
Yes.
You overcame some great odds with dyslexia and some other things. What were some of the other obstacles that you had to overcome?
Well, basically, the learning disabilities, and, you know, it's hard for people that don't have these disabilities. It's kind of hard to understand exactly. I try to give the analogy of imagine trying to win a swimming race with one arm tied behind your back. And that's the way that some of these issues come across. And it affected me greatly because I knew I didn't function like everybody else when I was little. But eventually, you focus on the things that you're strong at, and you learn to maneuver around the things you're weak at, and life goes on. Some of the other issues growing up were times were tough. My father was raising 4 kids as a GS-11 working for the Department of Defense. But, I mean, other than that, we led a pretty good life. Education was always an issue for me. But, again, once I got into the Air Force and I was exposed to their type of training and hands-on stuff, life took off for me, and it was a good choice.
You weren't just in the SSUD, and I want to get into that.
Sure.
You moved from there. Did you go from the SSUD to Tours?
Yeah. So the Secret Service, you know, is a pretty large agency. It's run by the agents. They're federal investigators. And, you know, the Secret Service's actually original mission was protection of the currency during the Civil War. And then eventually they got the duty of protection of the president. So the agents split those duties, protection and securing our currency. Then there's the uniform division that I was in. They're federal police officers. The uniform division has many, many jobs that most people don't know about. They do the metal detectors at the White House and around the world, wherever the president travels, then the vice president. They do the bomb-sniffing canine dogs. They do the counter-sniper teams that you see that protect the president and the vice president. They're 90% of the instructors out at the training center. And they also do the emergency response teams, the ERT teams that defend the White House and the vice president's residence. So, yeah, originally I was on the outer post. Then I interviewed and got the position to work outside the Oval Office. And then eventually I transferred over to the tour section of the White House. So there were the uniform division officers that do the tours for the first family, for the public. And that was a great job. It was a lot of fun. And I learned a lot about our country and the White House and the way it functions. And it was a great opportunity for me.
Mm-hmm. Like you said in the book, the people who do this, they really have to have this encyclopedic knowledge, right?
Yeah. When you give tours of the White House, there's a minimum, I think it's about 5 pages of minimum stuff you have to be able to talk about. that you're going to be tested on. I mean, I love the Secret Service and I love the job that they did, but I talk about some of the things that I saw as some of their management style that is bad. But that doesn't mean I don't believe in the Secret Service mission. I believe in it to my bones, but, you know, they have some management issues. But with that said, one of the things they do very well, when you're going to become a tour officer, you study the information, you practice it, and you know who says you can be a tour officer? The other tour officers. You have to give tours to the other officers to the point where they finally say, okay, he won't embarrass us or she won't embarrass us, so we'll let them come on. And they don't go easy on you. You have to give these tours to a sergeant and then at least two or three other officers. And some of the officers that you give these tours to, they've been given tours for years. I had to get past this one officer who had been working at the White House for 20 years and had been in the tour section for over 7 years. This guy could talk about the wood floors in one room of the White House for an hour.
Wow.
I mean, it was incredible, his knowledge.
Wow.
And so when I finally made it through, I had to test a couple times. You know, you have to speak in a certain way. And, you know, some of us come from different parts of the country. I come from outside of Philadelphia where we have certain, you know, word usages that are not usually correct. And when you're talking about a portrait of a first lady, you can't point to it and say, see that picture over there hanging on the wall? You know, we have to refer
right.
to it as being displayed and it's a portrait. And
or use guys look over here.
Use guys. That's exactly right. You nailed it. Use guys look over here. I will tell you, I probably got away with that a couple times.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
So I loved it. I thought it was great. Now, you know, one of the reasons I transferred over, because I'd been outside the Oval Office for about 3 years. And, you know, a lot of the things that I ended up talking about in my book that I ended up having to testify about had already happened. So to be honest with you, in hindsight, and I really realized this as I was writing the book, writing my book, Crisis of Character, where it actually turned out to be pretty cathartic for me. It was a lot cheaper than a therapist. I saw as I was writing the book that I kind of got away from it because I was bothered by the behavior of what I was seeing. I just knew. I can't describe to you why, but I knew it was going to blow up in our faces. You just can't continuously behave like that and not eventually get caught. I knew it was going to be a disaster, and it was. So unfortunately, I was right about that. I loved tours. It was great. I had many, many great experiences in the uniform division altogether and especially in the tour section.
And how long were you with tours again, Gar?
Probably a little over 2 years. I think I might have left early. I think I went out to the training center. An opportunity opened up where they were going to start a security detail. The Secret Service has this big training center near Beltsville, Maryland. It's about a little over 600 acres. And it was being secured by some special officers who work for the Secret Service, but they're a small group of guys. And they were having a lot of problems out at the training center with break-ins and poaching. It's like a wildlife refuge. And so there were people coming through the fence and hunting deer. And they started a security detail with the uniform division, and I was one of the original guys. And again, in hindsight, I think I went there to separate myself further from what I had seen. And I guess in the back of my mind, I knew what was coming.
I found it fascinating how here you are, obviously a strong believer in the American dream, and still, I'm sure.
Yes.
A lot of times people complain about the United States, and I do too. We want it to
sure.
be better.
Right, exactly.
And the one thing about this country that you can never take away from it is that if somebody wants to do something in the United States, they can do it if they put their mind to it. Nobody's going to stop.
Sure.
Unless it's something really up there, like with the Clintons, and I want to get into that. But you went from
right.
SSUD to tours to JJRTC, which is that facility. And
right.
then you went from there to a different area. Why don't you
yeah.
tell listeners about that? Both FAMs, is that what it is?
Oh, yeah, the Air Marshals, yes. 3 days after 9/11, we found out that they were going to expand the Federal Air Marshal Service. And again, in hindsight, I tell you that one of the reasons I transferred over to the primary reason was because of patriotism, and we were attacked with our own planes, and we needed to protect them. And I had these great skills at the Air Force and the Secret Service, and to be completely honest, you know, hunting all those years gave me these great skills, and it gave me this mentality where I believe it's important to protect other people. I always have, and I don't want to sound like I'm blowing smoke up my own backside, but I must be pretty good at it, and I thought my skills would be needed in the Air Marshal Service. So I applied, like a lot of people did, and I transferred over, and by the time the paperwork and interview, by the time I left the uniform division, it was 2003, and the Air Marshal Service was probably about a year old, 8 months old exactly, you know, expanded the way it is today. So I went over there, and I spent 13 years. In that 13 years, I flew over 4 million air miles, which is
wow.
166 times around the globe.
Jeez.
I figured it out one day. Yeah, so it's a very important job, but it's exhausting. It's tough on your family. It's a lot of separation, but it's a necessary job, and you have to train all the time. You have to train yourself. You just can't rely on the government training. You know, you have to practice on your own and your fighting skills, your shooting skills, and I loved it. I'm glad that I retired. I retired this past March, and I pray that my coworkers, my brothers and sisters that I work with continue to do it, and they will, but it's a tough lifestyle.
Yeah, I was pretty disheartened reading about that and the organization and what they did, and I hope that they clean that up, Gary.
Like I said, I love the Secret Service, the job that they did, but their management style back when I was there. Now, I realize they have a new director now, and he is trying to make some changes. So I can't really talk about that. But when I was there, the way we were managed and supervised had some issues. And it was very vindictive, and it was very hostile towards the employees. And they basically would work you into the ground and then move on. Years ago, there was a Secret Service agent when he retired. He sent this scathing telex memo to all the offices around the world, Secret Service offices. And at the end of his letter, he said, he referred to the Secret Service mentality was like the Cherokee Indian mentality. They would ride their horses until they died and they would eat them. And that's the way he felt the Secret Service treated its employees. And I had to agree with him. And unfortunately, the retired Secret Service agents that came over and started running the Air Marshal program brought that same mentality with them.
Yeah, I remember reading that in the book. Now, you said you were in the White House from, was it 91 to 2003? Is that right?
Yeah, the whole time I was there. Even when I was at the training center, I still came back to the White House. I was outside the Oval Office for roughly the first three, almost 4 years of the Clinton administration.
Mm-hmm. And you basically just stood guard in your uniform outside
right.
of the Oval Office.
Right. The post outside the Oval Office is referred to as E6. And the primary responsibility of that officer, the fixed uniform division posts in the White House are permanent. They're there all the time. They've been there for over 70 years, and they're there for certain reasons. The agents that protect the president, his personal protection agent group, they're there when the president's there. But the uniform division maintains that post outside the Oval Office 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So the main responsibility of that officer is, let's say the president's sitting at his desk and he's reading some classified information. If he gets up and goes to somewhere else in the White House and his staff doesn't secure or doesn't have time to secure that information and it's left open, then it's the officer's responsibility to cover it up. Or in some cases, we actually secure it. We have a safe on our post where we would lock it up. And that's the real reason that that officer's there, is to help secure classified information. And then secondary, you know, make sure who is coming up and down the hallway in the West Wing, have the right passes. You're also there to render first aid if needed. And of course, the bottom line is you're there to fight and defend the president and give the agents a long enough time to move the president to a secure location if we're attacked at the White House. And I loved the job. I loved everything about it. And I'm sure you see that when you read my book. It was tough, and I didn't like the negative things that happened. But I'm telling you, and this is one thing I want your listeners to understand. I want them to know who the real Hillary Clinton is. But understand this, if I was still in the Secret Service Uniform Division and she did become president, I would protect her just as vigorously as I did anybody else. That's what the job is. You have to separate the personal or the political from what reality is. And if she becomes the president, I would have protected her just like anybody else to the best of my ability.
Of course. On page 23, the White House is a shithead magnet.
Yeah.
And what does that mean exactly?
Yeah. So to put it in perspective for you, unfortunately, there's such a thing called mental illness, and everybody in the world who has issues, maybe they're not mentally ill to start out with, but if they get this ideal in their head that the President of the United States can help fix it, they come to Washington, D.C., and they come to the White House, and they come every day, and they show up all the time, 24 hours a day, at the White House, and it got so bizarre, it was entertaining, but you had to keep it in perspective, because a lot of times these people are sick. When I say sick, you know, they have mental illness, and sometimes I refer to them as just being crazy, and I don't mean crazy sick, I mean crazy like they're normal people, but they want an audience with the president because, for whatever reason, they think they have the answer to fix the world's problems. And it's fascinating to watch this play out in front of you when these people come up all the time and they try to sneak their way or finagle their way into the White House. And it was just fascinating.
Right. And of course, they can't all be Elvis Presley.
No, they cannot. And nor do they all bring gold-plated handguns. Elvis Presley brought Richard Nixon a gold-plated model 1911 Colt 45 ACP pistol. And when Nixon died, his daughter gave it to the Secret Service Firearms Library. It's out at the training center. And there's actually a book written about it. It's a fascinating story.
Wow. Yeah, I think I heard about that book. Yeah, that is a fascinating story. And you see here on page 26, Gare, that our most common arrests were for bum fights, disorderly conduct, suspicious activity, or fence jumping. And when you wrote the book, you said it's never been raised or made more secure. But of course, that's changed now, right?
Yeah, they're in the process of doing it, or they've done it, which is good. It needed to be done 50 years ago. But the security of the White House comes down to the Secret Service, but there's this other group of people called the White House Historical Association. And I get why they're there. You don't want them putting aluminum siding on the White House. I get that. Just to give your listeners a little bit better idea of what I'm talking about, before President Ronald Reagan was shot by John Hinckley, the Secret Service was trying to get metal detectors in the White House for years. And the White House Historical Association fought them on every turn of it. 3 days after Reagan was shot, the Secret Service was flying metal detectors from Italy back to Washington. They didn't even know how to use them. They went and bought them basically with a bag of cash and a chartered airplane for the military. And then we started using metal detectors. And then they learned how to build them into the walls so you couldn't even see them inside the White House. The White House fence has been jumped quite often for a long, long time, and it was obvious that it needed to be raised up, and the White House Historical Association was fighting them on it, and then not until there was almost a disaster with this fence jumper who got over the fence and into the mansion. Now, the Secret Service bears some of that responsibility, I get that, and I talk about that in the book, but there's times when you have to kind of modernize for safety and security reasons, and that's certainly one of the reasons.
Right, and they're raising the fence from 7 feet to 11 feet 7 inches, so it's pretty substantial. It's about a 50% jump.
Yeah, and that's exactly what they need, and that does a couple things. If somebody's going to breach the fence, now they got to bring equipment. They got to bring a ladder, and it gives the Secret Service Uniform Division and the agents time to respond and to prepare a couple extra seconds if that big attack comes, that they can defend the White House, and have no doubt they will. I worked there for many years, and I practiced that scenario many, many times in my head and in training, and I have no doubt whoever gets in there, I don't want it to be Mrs. Clinton, but if she does, they'll protect her, no matter how rude, arrogant, and disgusting she is to the Secret Service, which I talk about in my book.
Yes. I want to ask you, just for my own curiosity, on page 28 where you talk about in October 92, you were patrolling the Ellipse Park to the south of the White House in an unmarked van. Three long-haired, bearded guys dressed in blue jeans and green surplus Vietnam-era fatigue jackets were moving calmly and purposefully in tandem, cleaning out a white van and throwing bagged items into a trash can. I know you chased them for a long while, but you had to pull back. Did they finally get those guys?
No, they never did. And I have to tell you, in all my life, all the things that happened in my career, that's the one thing that I felt if we could have grabbed them, it would have been something significant. It's hard to describe how paramount what I saw, like I knew was evil, and I knew they were up to something bad, but we just couldn't get a hold of them quick enough to figure out what it was. They got away from us. So I did my best. I chased them almost all the way to King's Dominion. And I paid for it, but
yes, you did.
But you know, it is what it is. So you can't take the cop out of the cop some days. So,
that's right. Who do you suspect they were?
They moved like they were former military, for sure, as I described them. But I think they were some kind of serious, like, robbers, burglars, maybe even some kind of kidnappers. Who knows? But I had already been in the military. I've been around a lot of tough people in my life by that time. And when I saw the way this guy was carrying the knife I described in the book, it rang a bell. I knew these guys were serious people, and they had some serious training. And people don't normally function like this. Normal criminals do not move like these guys did. They don't act like they did, and they don't know how to evade like these guys did.
Right.
And these guys were trained people. They were either trained military at one time or very, very high-end career criminals.
Wow. And that was really the main thrust of your job, it seems, from reading your book, was actually profiling people on their behaviors.
Sure. Yeah, it's called behavior detection, and, mm-hmm. and the way people act and move, and just to give you a good description, if you go to a ballet, you expect to see a lot of slender, fit people moving very smoothly. If you're standing at the edge of the stage of that ballet, and you see some guy that looks like me now with a gut sticking out, and you know, with a pair of tights that looks like it's about to bust, that's a sign. There's something wrong there. You want to find out who that guy is. Why is he there? And that's really what behavior detection is, what stands out. The old Sesame Street thing, one of these things is not like the other. That's what behavior detection boils down to.
Right.
What are the norms in that area at that time, and why does this stand out? And that's what these guys were. Mm-hmm. They were outside the norm.
Yeah, very scary. I was like, oh, geez, he didn't mention if he caught him or not. Maybe I missed it or something, but thank you for telling me that.
Eventually I broke it off. The Virginia State Police had to break it off, and I took a verbal beating and got reprimanded for not breaking it off sooner, but it is what it is. Again, it's being a cop. You know what the right thing is, and sometimes the people that supervise you that aren't in the vehicle with you, they don't see what you don't have time to relay the message, and they second-guess my experience and my thought process, which is really the reason they hired me, but they second-guessed it, and that was one I wish I could take back. So.
Yeah, that would have been good. Let's get into your time there with the Clintons and being in such close proximity to them. This is very fascinating, Gary. On page 56, this is when you were talking about they wanted to change the entire telecommunications system that Bush 1 put in. And you say the Clinton administration hadn't anticipated that it had to actually pay for things, and the bill blindsided them. Do you think this is like their mentality, that they're coming to like an all-expense-paid type of vacation when they're in the White House? Did it strike you
as that? Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely, it did. that is one way it struck me. And it also struck me as people who were used to getting what they wanted with just saying something, but never having any responsibility to pay for it, which goes back to the kind of Hillary Clinton's political philosophy where they want these huge government programs, but it costs money and they don't work, you know, a lot of times. And that was the thing. When you look at them replacing the phone system, they were replacing a perfectly good phone system because they were paranoid. I did the escort for part of this phone replacing thing on a couple Sundays, and I worked with the AT&T technicians that were replacing the computers and the phones and everything. And they said that the Clinton administration told them flat out it was because they thought the Republicans were listening in on the phone conversation. Paranoia drove them to spend millions of dollars that they didn't have, and it wasn't necessary.
And it was the people's money.
No, right. Taxpayers' dollars. That's our income that they're taking from us and using poorly.
Right. Like Gore, you mentioned on that same page.
Yeah.
Tell the listeners about what he was doing. What a strange bird.
Yeah. So Vice President Gore, as vice president, he lived at the Naval Observatory. The vice president's residence is at the Naval Observatory. And it's this beautiful old Victorian home. They had just done a major renovation and put in all these new alarms, smoke detectors, heat detectors into the residency. Detectors that detected the type of air that was in the room, smoke, heat, everything you could imagine. So one day, because it's a small area, the agents in the office share the same break room and alarm room. So one day, one of the alarms goes off, like a smoke detector goes off, then a heat detector, and then some other detectors. And they're like, oh my God, there's something really wrong. So the lead agent and a couple agents and a couple uniform division officers, they go running across from where the control room is, across the lawn to the residence. They let themselves in. They run up the steps to where the alarms originate. And there's the vice president standing on a chair, pulling the alarms out of the ceiling, out of the roof, because he thought they were observation or listening devices. And again, there's paranoia, you know, their paranoia coming through. And it wasn't like easy and cheap to fix either. I mean, this is expensive, sensitive stuff. So clearly I wasn't there. But I know it happened because I heard it 3 or 4 times. I heard it from the head of the detail. I was in the gym not too long after that, and the lead agent on the vice president's detail told me the whole story over again, and he just couldn't get over it. He's like, God, they're so paranoid about stuff, you know, which leads you to believe, why are you paranoid? Why is it so important that nobody knows what you're doing? You know what I mean? What is it you're doing that you don't want anybody to see? That's what you have to ask about Mrs. Clinton and this server that she had at the State Department. What were you doing that you didn't want us to see?
Let's take a look at what you said about her. You said on page 57, while the president, who you consider to be a very charming guy, while the president must have vented his frustrations to the staff, because he didn't do it to you guys, right?
No, not generally speaking, no.
Mrs. Clinton vented on everyone, and it got worse the more at home she felt in the White House. And then you say on page 60 to 61 that she'd explode in my face without reservation or decorum. And then, of course, when she's walking with VIP, she did something completely different. Why don't you tell listeners about that?
Yeah, so one particular story that I tell, it was around Christmas time, and the first lady sent somebody and her staff down to the Oval Office. I think it was a weekend, it was a Saturday, they were decorating the White House, and there was a group of women up from Arkansas who had been invited up to help decorate the White House. So Mrs. Clinton wanted them to come over to the Oval Office and be able to go in there and take pictures. The president wasn't there at the time, which is fine, but once Mrs. Clinton and her staff person who would be escorting them leave the Oval Office, they all have to leave. And these aren't Secret Service rules. These are rules based on laws, national security laws. There's reasons that I don't go into that you can't leave a bunch of people in the Oval Office for long periods of time unescorted. So I explained this to the staff member, and the staff member berated me first, which I kind of rolled my eyes at. And then she said, well, I'm going to go tell the First Lady, you know, that you're not going to let us do this. And I'm like, it's not me. It's what the law is. The rules are. So she leaves. The First Lady comes back and walks up and says, you know, I hear we have a problem. She starts berating me and says, you know, we should have got rid of you a-holes years ago. I'm so tired of working with you and putting up with this crap. Now, this is a liberal person who loves these big government programs, but when she has to follow the rules and guidelines, she doesn't want anything to do with it. So I found it incredibly comical, and to the point where I didn't physically roll my eyes, but I was rolling my eyes as she was berating me. And eventually, I did what I was supposed to do, which was one of the reasons I was assigned to that post outside the Oval Office, was I found a compromise that would take care of the security needs. And so I basically told the First Lady that when they were done, all they had to do was walk them across the hallway into the Roosevelt Room, and they could leave them there. And if there was a problem, that staff person would have to come back and get them, but they could leave them there for a short period of time. And so that was the compromise. And that was just one example of, and I say many examples, as you know, where she berates people. Now, I didn't take it personally because I didn't take her seriously. I mean, she was the First Lady, and she treated people like crap all the time. And it was almost comical. I'm like, how does this woman think that anybody takes her seriously? She gets wrapped around the axle. She doesn't try to fix the problems. Leaders fix problems, and they move on, and they take that fixed problem, and they use it as an asset. That's not what Hillary Clinton does.
How close did she get in your face, Gar?
She was probably about a foot away, which again was comical because I'm 6'2", and at the time I probably weighed about 200 pounds, and she's 5'5", 5'7", whatever she is, and she was looking up at me. Saturday Night Live couldn't have written it any funnier. To me at the time, it appeared to be funny, and certainly when I was reliving it and writing it, I thought it was very funny again.
But then, on one hand, she berates you, she humiliates you, but then on the other hand,
right,
what does she do? She introduces you.
Yeah. So a short time later, I go over to the mansion, and I'm helping complete this tour with this group, and she reintroduces me, and, you know, she's got her hand on my shoulder, and she's telling them how much she enjoyed working with Officer Burns since they've come to the White House, to the point I'm like, oh, my God, this lady's delusional. She can't stand us, you know, and at one point, I almost believe her. I want to believe her, but I know what the truth is. I smiled, and I thanked her, and I did the right thing. I was polite, and I gave the tour, and I was nice to the people, and then, you know, life goes on. And then the next crazy thing happens, you know?
Wow. Let me know, Gar, if I read this correctly. On page 75, where you're talking about when her detail passed, Mrs. Clinton expected everyone else to disappear. What's that about?
Yeah, they started doing this thing where she made it clear that she wanted people in the hallways when she was coming to hide or move. She didn't want to see anybody. And I protected these people, like everybody in the Secret Service. I didn't do it by myself. I was just one small person in that giant cog. But I took that a little personally, where around the White House, first of all, I'm standing post. I'm not hiding anywhere. What I'm referring to in the book, I believe, is when we're on a detail. I think it was in Ohio. And I was standing post in the hallway where the president and the first lady were going to come down and enter into this ballroom in front of our position. And again, the reason I was there is because I knew all the staff. And anyway, this agent was an agent from out of town. And he said, oh, listen, my boss says when they come down the hallway, we have to move back into the kitchen. And I looked at him and laughed. And I said, can you protect them from the kitchen? And he said, well, no, but that's what we were told they do at the White House. I said, well, that's what some people do at the White House. It's not what I'm doing. So anyway, he's like, okay, Mr. Tough Guy. So they come down the hallway. He ducks into the kitchen. I stand my post like I'm supposed to. And the president looked over at me and actually nodded, acknowledged me. And then the first lady was talking. And then the agent in charge that was pushing the shift that day, as we call it, he looked over as they were walking in, and he looked at me like with a glare, like he wanted to set me on fire. But I just found it ridiculous. Don't get me wrong. I know the agents are around them, and they're protecting them. But if that minute or the 2 minutes before an attack had started, everybody needed to be there to protect them. And that's the mentality you have to have. It's going to happen any second, and this is the way it's going to happen. It's going to be vicious, violent, and you have to return that viciousness and violence as fast as you can to protect them. And that's the job.
Why do you think, Gar, that she wanted you all to disappear? What was the motive?
Because she despises us. She despises the military. She despises law enforcement. I talk about this, as you know, extensively in my book, Crisis of Character. She despises military and law enforcement. She is a dictator. She's the definition of a dictator. She wants all these big government programs, but she doesn't want to follow the rules. She wants to be able to, with the wave of a pen, have things done her way. And the truth is, she's a terrible decision maker. We've seen that many, many times over her entire public career. She gets fired as a Watergate investigator. She loses to a first-term senator from Illinois that nobody knew, and then he makes her Secretary of State, and that was a complete disaster. It certainly was a disaster for those people in Benghazi, and then the email server. I mean, how is it that anybody thinks that Hillary Clinton can lead? She doesn't even understand, after 8 years as a senator, that you can't have your own private server. Clearly, she knew that. She did it to keep the information away from the American public.
Right, and she did, unfortunately. And
yeah.
With Comey, FBI Director Comey, who I went to high school with.
What a tough position he's in.
Yeah, that's right. And probably when he said what he said, that no reasonable prosecutor would do that, he meant, geez, no reasonable prosecutor would dare do that, because then they'd have to go up against the Clintons. And you said in here that you feared them.
Sure.
Page 165, we simply feared the Clintons. Do you still fear them?
No, not really. I mean, yeah, a little bit. And what I mean by that is, when I was protecting them, I feared the way they acted. Both of them were so reckless in their behavior. For God's sakes, I mean, when you read my book and you just look at the scandals, in 8 years that he was in office, there were 19 scandals. I don't fear physically for my life or my family's life. Listen, I've been protecting myself and other people for a long time. I know what it takes to do it, and I've taken those precautions. I've also made the right steps in getting the right large law firm to help protect myself, because I knew the way they would come at me. I know the Clinton machine. I'm a subject matter expert on these people. And if your listeners get a chance to read my book, they'll see that. I've taken steps to protect myself. But with that said, there's a certain amount of risk. But I feel so strongly about people knowing who the real Hillary Clinton is that I'm willing to take that risk. This is my mission now. I'm no longer a federal police officer. I'm retired. This is my mission.
And you just retired, you said, and I meant to say congratulations on that.
Thank you.
After
I
what?
Made it,
Yes, yeah. What was it, 29 years, you said?
29 years, yep.
Four or you might not have said it, I read it. Yeah, 29 years.
Yeah, 29 years, 4 years in the Air Force, 12 years in the Secret Service Uniform Division, and 13 years as an Air Marshal. God, I'm exhausted.
Yeah, you know what? I don't know how you did it, man. I really don't. One of the reasons that I wanted to do this interview was to let the listeners know about the real Hillary Clinton, because you were able to see her all those years face to face, and you knew what she was about, and you saw both the husband and wife, and you pointed out, and I'll let the listeners examine that when they read the book, about their relationship, how they really were not like a happy couple together. When they were in public, they were one way. When they were in private, they were another.
Right.
But tell listeners about, because this is a startling story. The fella who, I guess he was relatively new there, and this is on page 70. One day, UD officers met to review events at their respective posts. A bewildered new officer arrived, and he says, hey, you'll never believe it. And Gary, if you want to use the actual language that she used, that would be fine, if you're comfortable doing
okay.
it. I'm comfortable.
Yeah, I'm fine. And this story is painful in a couple of ways. This is one of the things that always bothered me. You know, whatever happened, they said to me or happened to me, that's me and I can deal with it. But this guy was a new officer, had been on about a year, year and a half. He's walking down the West Colonnade, which is the outside walkway that connects the mansion, the White House proper, to the West Wing. And he's walking towards the mansion. The First Lady's walking towards him. And he says, good morning, First Lady. And she looks at him and says, go fuck yourself. How can that possibly be okay? It just goes back to what I said earlier about her disdain for the military and for law enforcement. If you saw your doctor talk to his employees or his security like that at his office, you would never go to them again. You would run as fast as you could.
Right.
The other bizarre thing about that story is, now she couldn't have known this, but she did know he was a uniform division officer. 4 years before that, this guy was in the Army, roughly 4 years. And he had been deployed in one of the earlier missions to Somalia. Not the story that we would know now as Black Hawk Down, but before that. And this guy had been wounded. He'd been shot. The bullet sneaked under his body armor. He was badly wounded. And he survived, obviously, and he got a Purple Heart. He went there to Somalia in the U.S. Army under orders from Bill Clinton. 3 or 4 years later, he comes to the White House to protect them again, be in the Secret Service and protect the Clintons. And the First Lady tells him to go fuck himself. I'm sorry. That's unacceptable. And I know it's true because it was investigated. It wasn't the first time it happened, and it wasn't the last time it happened. It's the way she treats people. She treats people like she's a dictator and everybody else is below her. Now, what does that say about the psychology of their mind, how their mind works,
right.
how she looks at people? That's the real Hillary Clinton. She despises us. She despises the common person. She despises the military. She is all about gaining control and power. And it will not be good for the American people, I promise you. That's my experience, and that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, Crisis of Character.
I guess seeing them up close and personal, on page 117, you say that by 1994, and they got into office, that was January 20th, 93, right? So it says, by 1994, I no longer felt the allegiance to the man who now occupied that office. I mean, that says a lot.
Yeah, I'd seen enough. I mean, don't get me wrong. I believed in the office of the presidency. I was protecting the office of the presidency. But the human being, Bill Clinton, I mean, I realize we're all human, but his faults, the things he was doing and the affairs, and it was just something that you couldn't respect. And it's not the way I was wired. And it's not the way most people in the Secret Service were wired. But you have to learn to set that aside. I still protected them to the best of my ability, and I helped the agents and the other parts of the uniform division and the Secret Service do the best they could to protect them, but the things I saw changed my opinion of the person, Bill Clinton, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And I want to tell the listeners that there's something in this book that, and I don't want to get into it because I want it to be a surprise for
you,
but there's something in this book that you'll be very surprised about, because Gary, personally, individually, significantly, had so much to do with the whole Monica Lewinsky matter coming to light. I think that the readers will be in for a big surprise.
Yeah.
Wow, I didn't know any of this stuff, Gar, and didn't realize the huge part you played in exposing this.
My unfortunate claim to fame, I'm not sure if I've said this already in the interview today with you, but my unfortunate claim to fame was that I was the first employee of the U.S. Secret Service to ever be compelled to testify in a criminal case against the sitting president, and that was the Monica Lewinsky case. I was actually subpoenaed 6 times and eventually ordered to testify by Chief Justice Rehnquist. So not something you want to put on your resume, and that's one of the reasons that when I was toying with the idea of coming out, and I knew this would be horrendous, and I knew the Secret Service, it would put pressure on them, but how did I get there? I got there because President Bill Clinton wasn't man enough to come forward. If he had come forward in the very beginning when the accusations were out there and Judge Starr thought he knew what he knew, which he did, and came out and said, I did do this, it was wrong, and then move forward. But no, they did what the Clintons always do. They turned everything into a huge scandal with all these lies, and they caused all this destruction to other people's lives, to all the uniform division officers. And again, I'm not concerned about myself. I survived pretty good. A lot of the agents and officers, they did not. And then they had the Secret Service manipulating the whole legal thing because they were trying to force this group of officers forward and protect themselves. So it was a very bizarre time. But even with those things, as you alluded to in the book, there were times where I tried to do things that would protect him, and you just can't help them help himself.
It's pretty obvious, I think, to a lot of people nowadays that America isn't what it was when, and we're about the same age, Gary. You're 54, I'm 56. We grew up in the same part of the country. There was no internet. Really, we didn't spend time. We were outside all the time, right?
Every day.
Right, every day. We had like baseball cards put in the spokes of our bikes, and that was
That's us. Yeah.
Right, exactly. We had a great life. I did.
Yes,
I know,
you did.
I know you did from reading your fine book.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of people now who feel that the country is slipping away from us. I think you feel the same way.
I do.
Too many things going on.
Concerns, yeah.
Yes, for the blatant refusal to respect the immigration laws, to whatever else it might be. You say here on page 123 about the White House, they knew how important they were to the White House. This is all the staff at the White House. And how important the White House was to the nation. Do you still believe that Americans on the whole consider the White House to be as important as it might have been back when you were there?
I hope so. Probably not in some cases because of these scandals. Here's the thing, put it in a nutshell. My fear is that people don't respect it and think of it, put it on a pedestal like I did and like you obviously do. I'm afraid people don't do it now, and I understand why, but I do believe we can get back there. And what it comes down to behavior. It's this simple. When you talk about any of these modern day discussions we're having, Black Lives Matter, Police Lives Matter, everybody's life matters. It's about behavior. It's how I behave towards you. It's how you behave towards me. You know, we're a country of laws and rules. If you can't function inside those laws and rules, then maybe this isn't the place for you. It's going to end up blowing up in your face. I'm not saying everybody has to toe the line 100% of the time, all the time, and be goody-two-shoes. But there's certain things you don't do. When the police tell you to stop doing something, you stop doing it. You don't tell them that you're a member of the White House staff and they don't have to follow your rules. There's guidelines. We're trying to be a polite society. And there's a group now, certainly a thrust in the Democratic Party, where they don't want to follow any rules. They want you and I to do it, and they want us to pay all these tax dollars, the American people, to support all these crazy programs, but they don't want to follow the rules themselves. And it's at the point now where people realize it. And the truth is, it comes down to behavior. And if you don't behave well, you're not going to do well. That's the bottom line. People don't want to admit it.
Right. That's why when you mentioned this Black Lives Matter, it doesn't matter that the black kid was a criminal, like you just saw in Chicago. He stole a Jaguar and he's ramming it into police cars. But the big deal is that the police shot him and how they shot him. They stopped the threat, but that doesn't matter. What matters is how they did it. Yeah, everything's reverse. Everything's upside down.
Yeah, it's disheartening.
It is disheartening. You said, Gary, you talked about on page 153, you talked about basically the Clinton body count, which everyone is familiar with, or most people are familiar with, the sheer number of people who have died under mysterious circumstances around the Clintons. I think it was about 120. This past week, we had a rash of deaths. Did you hear about that?
I did. I follow it. I try to take it with a grain of salt, but, you know, I see what everybody else sees that wants to look at it. I talk about this in my book. I'm sure you're familiar with it. In the early 90s, I was working with an Arkansas deputy sheriff, and I was discussing with him at the time, you know, the early 90s, this young governor, Bill Clinton, his governor that was going to run for office, and all these mysterious deaths around them, all the information about these affairs and his supposed drug use, alleged drug use. And I said to this deputy sheriff, I'm like, there's no way this guy is ever going to be president of the United States. And he looked at me like he was looking right through me. He said, Gary, let me tell you something. Everything you hear about these people is true. I'm from Arkansas. I've seen it all. My father saw it all. And if he runs for office, he'll become president of the United States, and he'll be there for 8 years. And he says, I'm telling you, these people, there's a reason we refer to them as the Arkansas Mafia. They can spin shit in the gold. And everything this guy said and all those scandals that were supposedly stories planted by the right-wing conspiracy all came true. We saw it happen in the 8 years that he was there with the 19 scandals when he was president. So it's just a bizarre time we live in.
It is, my friend. I should have mentioned before, when the folks do read your connection to Monica Lewinsky and, of course, what followed with Ken Starr and all that, these people put you and your family through hell. I didn't realize how bad it was, or what the FBI is supposed to be, I guess, on your team, what they did to you and the pressure they put on you and your pregnant wife. It was just so sad.
Yeah.
And I want the readers to understand, because not only do you provide an incredible view and glimpse into the White House, but you also provide a horrendous view and glimpse into the American justice system and how they treat people and what they did to you, somebody who is a man who served his country for all those years. I mean, if they treat you like that, what does that say? So that was very disheartening.
That's the standard Clinton operating procedure. Everybody that gets caught up in their scandals ends up getting crapped on. And that's what will happen if she becomes president. Nothing's going to change. It's going to be the same Arkansas mafia that they talked about in the early 90s. So,
how are Jenny, Elizabeth, and Ethan handling now the book?
Pretty good. I try to talk to them every day about it, and we laugh. Ethan read the book. We talked to him about the sexual parts in it. Elizabeth hasn't read it yet, and I said to her, when are you going to read the book? She goes, Dad, I've been listening to you do these radio shows for over a month now. I know everything about your damn life, and I'm tired of hearing about it. So they're doing pretty good. They're great kids. I'm so lucky. God, Jenny and I are so lucky. And Jenny's dealing with it. Once in a while, she shows little signs of pressure. It's hard for a wife to watch people rip her husband apart when she knows what the truth is. But we talked about that beforehand. We knew what we were getting into. We'd been through it before when the Lewinsky scandal broke. Now this time I get to tell the truth, the whole truth, publicly, and really what happened from all aspects, how it affected not just me, but the other people involved in it. So we're dealing with it well. Thank you for asking.
Sure. I saw you on Hannity's show. I watched a YouTube video of it. I don't know if you've been on that program, Fox, a couple of times or just that once.
I have.
Okay.
Yep.
What other networks have you been on? And tell the listeners about not just the mainstream media blackout of your book, and of course the criticism of without even reading it, and of course the criticism that's online about saying, well, Byrne couldn't have been doing that because he was only this, he was only that.
Yeah.
That's impossible.
Right.
Tell listeners about that.
Right before my book came out, we actually had scheduled with ABC, CBS, The Today Show. And then when they found out what the book was about, the Clintons found out. According to one person, and I won't give their name up because they asked me not to, but they work for the Fox Network, and they were talking to another booker from a radio show. And they made it so very clear that this booker was told under no circumstances could they have me on the show. And this was the Clinton administration putting pressure on them. Now, they have plenty of time on these shows to bash me, slander me, and call me a liar, but they don't have the 10 minutes it would take to have me on there, confront me, ask me legitimate questions, and have me give them the honest answers and defend myself and tell the truth. I don't care what people think about me personally. I want them to understand what the truth is about this woman. So here's the way I kind of frame it up. The Democratic nomination to be the president of the United States is basically forcing the mainstream media to crush my First Amendment rights. If it wasn't for Fox News and radio show hosts like yourself, I would never get my message out. And it has worked, and it is getting out there, and I appreciate it. But it's kind of ironic. Back during this Lewinsky scandal that I was pushed into by the president's bad behavior and the Secret Service's manipulating of the situation, myself and my coworkers were pushed into, every news agency in the world wanted to talk to us. But we didn't, because we followed the directions of the Secret Service. I have clips from every major newspaper in this country, stories about myself and my coworkers, the Star investigations compelling Byrne forward. The Secret Service doesn't want them to talk. But now that I'm coming out and telling my story, they're buckling the pressure from Mrs. Clinton. It's just bizarre. But it's par for the course. It's what I expected. And when you hear somebody say, oh, he never could have seen that, you want to know what I saw? Ask Mrs. Clinton's chief spokesperson, Jennifer Palmieri. She used to be Leon Panetta's assistant. I saw her every day. John Podesta, who's also a major part in her campaign, I saw him every day. These people know who I am. That's why they're squashing me, because they're afraid of the truth. They know what I saw, they know what they did, and they're terrified of it. I think eventually it will falter as time goes on. I would love to get the 10 minutes on the TV show The View and defend myself, because Joy Behar and some of those other people have just taken as much time as they could to rip me apart in front of the country. I'd like a little time to defend myself. I'd also like to mention to you that I've actually are taking legal action against the Retired Secret Service Agents Association for Defamation of Character, Media Matters, and David Brock, and I'm also firing letters with the major news agencies for allowing them to come on and slander me without a chance to defend myself. So it's a slow process, but we're working on it, and I appreciate everybody who's helping me with that.
Good for you, Gary. Have you been shut out of everything except for Fox News?
Fox News is the only one that's had me on. And, of course, radio. Lots of radio like you guys, and I greatly appreciate it. I've done some print interviews over the phone, but not much. But there may be more to come. Things are changing, and I have great hope. And, again, it's funny when you hear, like, a group of these women that were on this TV show, The View, oh, he's just doing this for money. Trust me, it ain't about the money. It's about getting the message out. Am I going to make money from this book? Yeah, eventually I will. But it's expensive to do what I'm doing. I had to basically borrow money from somebody to hire these lawyers to protect myself and my family. And that will get paid back. And it is as we speak. But I'm not interested in selling books as far as making money. I want to sell books because I want people to know what the truth is. And then vote your conscience. And I believe if people read this book and do a little education on their own about Mrs. Clinton and the way the Clinton machine works, you'll see that she is not the best choice. That's not the person you want to take a chance on running this country.
I know 1/1,000,000th of what you know, but I think that from, what was it called, Garrett? Behavioral what?
Behavioral detection.
From this behavioral detection that anybody could do just
right.
By looking at these people and seeing what they're all about. I think people need to wake up, and even though they're shutting you down, it still is a bestseller, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's going to be on the New York Times bestseller list, number one, 5 weeks in a row next week. It'll be the fifth week.
Holy
it's
mackerel.
Incredible. And I'm very grateful to everybody who's taken the time to buy my book. I appreciate it.
Wow, that is incredible, because here it is. Here's an example of where the entire mainstream media, except for one channel, is shutting
yeah.
you down, and your book is still the number one bestseller for 5 weeks in a row.
It is. We struck a nerve. Like you were saying, there's people out there that want to know the truth, and this is what the real deal is. This is the way she is, and this is how she functions. And if she gets in office, we're going to see the same thing that we saw with her husband's administration. Because have no doubt, when the country elected Bill Clinton, they got Bill and Hillary. If we elect Hillary Clinton, you're going to get Hillary and Bill, and we're going to jump from one scandal to the next, and who's going to be governing the country? It's not a risk worth taking twice.
Gary J. Byrne, former Presidential Secret Service officer and the author of Crisis of Character, a White House Secret Service officer discloses his firsthand experience with Hillary, Bill, and how they operate. Gary, I want to thank you so much for the time you spent explaining all this to the listeners, and looking forward to talking to you again real soon.
Thank you so much for your time, and I appreciate it.